It was Napoleon who said that China is a sleeping giant. When she awakes, she will shake the world. Well, she's certainly awoken. Today, China is an indubitable global superpower, rivaling the USA. On some metrics, it has already built the world's most futuristic, productive economy. Even if militarily, it still lags behind the United States, although even there it is arming at an astonishing pace. History is scant comfort, argue many. Rising powers and incumbent powers have always tended to clash in open warfare. There are dark predictions that a Sino-US war is inevitable, with Trump's tariff wars and tech bans a forerunner of worse to come. That's become part of the new consensus. China will invade Taiwan in the 2030s, and the United States will inevitably retaliate. A third world war is inevitable. But is it? Does either superpower really want full-scale war? Maybe a rivalrous coexistence is just as likely, a continuation of what's been happening over the last 40 years. Joining us today is Professor Rana Mitter, a leading expert on modern China and its global role. As the S.T. Lee Chair in U.S.-Asia Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School, his subtle insights offer a vital and very different perspective. Understand the past better to inform the present, he argues, and thus the future of U.S.-China relations, which may be less dark than many predict. Rana, great to have you with us.
Well, very good to be with you. Thanks very much for those kind words and looking forward to an intriguing conversation.
Now, there is this dark picture of kind of US-China relations, which you've consistently, whilst not dismissing, kind of challenged and said, actually, something more interesting is going on between these two powers. I mean, do you want to just set out your stall and we can start unpacking it?
I think that's right, Will. So briefly, I think, first of all, one of the reasons that we do have a lot of the very sort of, you know, dark and brooding type of description of US-China relations that you outlined very effectively at the beginning is that in some ways, it's about the nature of the US and China themselves. I would say, big claim here, feel free to, you know, pick me up on it, that perhaps India and China are the only two countries in the world today that tell big apocalyptic stories about themselves as well as about each other. In other words, we sort of veer from, you know, America's going to dominate the world to America's about to collapse, or China's going to be the kind of global dominant power to China's economy is going to fall over a cliff. But it always has to be a sort of 100 or zero type point. And I think the reality in both cases is that both the fast-changing societies, which are going to interact with each other because they cannot really avoid doing so for decades to come, yet at the same time, I think we can see an outcome which is going to be, I think, more complicated than simply one side winning and one side losing. And very broadly speaking, let me give you one thought as to why I think on the China side that's likely to be the case. It's the question of what is it that China actually wants to do in the world in the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And I put it this way. China, I think, is very interested in what you might call a series of concentric circles of power, by which I mean that within its own geographical area and in terms of the areas where it's traditionally had influence, probably over the last, you know, few hundred years, I think there is no doubt that China would like to be the dominant power in the region. And I think we can see a way in which essentially China's message to the region is that China should be the leading power in Asia, and by implication or explication, should not be the US. I would say that the further those concentric circles move out from China geographically, the more they turn from black to gray, you might say. So, for instance, economic power is something that China really does want to exercise globally. And also beyond that, platforms, tech platforms, communications technology, the underpinning for a 2030s, which will be very much linked to AI and the Internet of Things. China definitely wants to be a leader in those sorts of areas, as well as in green energy. But it's not, I think, interested in the kind of traditional territorial expansion that old-fashioned empires might have been doing in the 19th century. And finally, there's one other area that spreads beyond those. That is the sort of cyber and tech area, which doesn't necessarily have a geographical range at all. I think, again, China's interested in being very powerful in all of those places. But because we haven't looked at those differentiated areas of power that China's interested in, I think we've gone back to a sort of Cold War vision in which it's going to be America versus China, both essentially wanting a version of the same thing, both duking it out. I think the picture is far more complex than that.
That's very interesting. I buy that. The United States, it runs North America, obviously, and South America too, two continents which are its kind of sphere influence, and indubitably. And China, in that particular part of Asia, is the hegemon. It sees itself having a frontier in the sea, which Taiwan right. is part, and the various islands there, and it doesn't like the notion of the American Navy regarding so much the South China Sea as part of its hegemon. That's the flashpoint, is it not? I mean, that's what, if you talk to the neocons and the others in Washington, that's what they'll tell you. And then actually, you know, the Americans got to push back against that advance. But you would say something different, I think.
I think that's right. And I do talk to people of all political persuasions in Washington and elsewhere out here in the US and try and get what I hope is a broad-ranging view of the question. So, you know, let's just take, I think, the very astute premise that you put forward there. First of all, let's take some, you know, pretty empirical data. If you look at Chinese military buildup, China now has the second biggest military in the world. I think, you know, converted dollar for dollar, you're looking at a budget of about, some people say about 160, 170 billion US dollars a year. Not as big as the United States, which still, you know, holds the pole position, but it's a very large amount of military spending if you don't intend to do anything. So the question is, what is all that military spending actually for? And folks in the Philippines, for instance, could tell you about the way in which the increasing incursion of Chinese naval presence and paranaval presence, often what's sometimes called grey hulls and white hulls, is the sort of differentiation people make in terms of trying to push the maritime boundaries that China wants to control further and further. So all of that, I think, is real and a very intense security problem in the region. And by the way, the continued presence of the US security presence in the region, naval, air force, troops, and so forth, is, I think, in the eyes of most countries in the region, a very important part of keeping a pushback against China's desire to have that much greater control. That's troops on the ground in South Korea. That is initiatives such as the UK, Australia, and the US coming together with AUKUS on nuclear-powered submarines. It's also, of course, about places like Singapore becoming partners in terms of US military projection in the Western Pacific. And I would say, by the way, you know, talking to people in the region as well, whatever they may say in public, I think very few countries in the region would actually want the US to withdraw from the region precisely for those purposes. I think it is the case that if there were some move that basically went across one of China's red lines, Taiwan declaring independence, for instance, they generally said, that might well lead to a horrific confrontation between two sides. But if we don't get that, then actually think about it from Beijing's point of view. You're sitting there with a bunch of people in the People's Liberation Army, very well-equipped army, very well-trained. We have no idea how they do in combat because China hasn't fought an international war since 1979 when they invaded Vietnam. So actually, unlike the Russians, Brits, and Americans, we don't know much about Chinese actual combat capability in the real world. Now, I don't know if you've ever had the chance to kind of look at the beaches of Taiwan, but let's just say that they make D-Day look like a picnic. You'd have to have a really large fleet to do actually what would be probably the world's most ambitious amphibious landing that's ever, you know, bigger than D-Day, bigger than Incheon, bigger than Iwo Jima. So even if you've got the capacity to do it, you don't want to do it unless you absolutely know that you've got no other choice. And I think the Chinese would think, and this is where we get to the kind of granularity of policy that really people need to understand better. If you look at a rather different set of statistics, the statistics from Taiwan's last presidential election, which was in January of last year, you will see things which are giving many people, I think, in China pause for thought about how they might pull off a Taiwan unification. They're looking at the fact that the current ruling party, which is pro-autonomy, and you know, I think ideally in their eyes they would want independence, but they're worried about what would happen if they declared it. It's becoming increasingly unpopular, partly because the economic situation in Taiwan is not great, but also because Chinese social media, cyber, you know, influencing is going on a day-by-day, hour-by-hour basis in Taiwan. A lot of people are getting Chinese propaganda from the mainland saying, you can't fight, give up, you know, do a deal with us now, it'll be better than waiting to be attacked. If those two factors shape enough votes in the next Taiwan presidential election, which is only in 2028, it's not very far away, and after the president was elected who might do some kind of deal with Taiwan, that would get Beijing much closer to where it wants to be without a shot being fired, a barge being sent out into the Pacific Ocean, or a missile silo having to be prepared. So those sorts of understandings of what might be happening inside the decision-making process in Beijing, rather than assuming there's one big monolithic worldview in China, that's the kind of detail that I think we need to be thinking about more and understanding how the US-China dynamic would also work. One other thing to throw at you, Will, is that right now, consensus seems to be changing in the United States. And there's a growing thought that with President Trump and President Xi possibly meeting on the outskirts of the APEC meeting in Seoul in South Korea in a couple of months' time, could that be the beginning of the two superpowers, these two strongmen leaders, actually thrashing out a deal without the need for the foreign ministry and the State Department and all the experts and the neocons and the doves and the pacifists coming together? In other words, are two big global players going to carve out a new way forward on China? A lot of people are talking about this right now.
We're going to follow through on that, right? I just wanted to take you to a different corner of the forest, which is kind of China's extraordinary economy. You do highlight in your writing more vividly than most, if there's any world economy that personifies the future, it's China's. I mean, if Britain personified the marvels of capitalism in the 19th century and the United States in the 20th, I mean, China's looking as though it's the power above any other that personifies it in the 21st century. I mean, people who come back from China come back open-mouthed, actually. I need to go again, actually. I haven't been for a year or two, but I need to see it with my own eyes.
Do go and take a look. I think that's important. I mean, as we speak, this is early October. I was last there about 6 weeks ago in late August in Beijing. And I was, you know, living the whole life on my phone, you know, kind of taxi rides or Didi, as it's called over there, paying for my noodles, you know, and then making sure that I kind of tell which direction I was walking in. Of course, all of that phone being, I'm sure, carefully monitored by the authorities.
Yeah, no question.
And actually, one of the things people will tell you is that you need to keep your phone charged and topped up hugely when you're using Chinese apps. And one of the reasons is that, of course, there's so much surveillance going on. The amount of energy suck is actually huge, because when, you know, an entire government is trying to get all the data and pull it in, that doesn't come for free. That comes with an awful lot of data hunger. So let me use that to reflect back to you a point that you've just made there in terms of what underpins all this, because if our wider theme is, you know, US-China as well and how things are differentiating, I think we reached another really important fork in the road in the first quarter of this year, of 2025. Up to that point, the policy of the previous Biden administration in the US had been what became known, again, for British ears, it sounds a bit odd, the IRA, but it stands for Inflation Reduction Act, which was a rather misleading name. You're a top economist, Will, so you'll recognize this. It was really actually much more about green energy production, but I think they thought that inflation reduction sounded better to sell to the American people, even though I guess not quite enough of them actually voted for it. But it did put forward essentially industrial strategy by another name. And again, Will, that's one of your areas of expertise, you know, putting in investments, trying to spread it across the red states and the blue states, but really making a commitment saying that energy transition, along with fossil fuel, is something that America's going to do. I don't think we're in that world now. I think the current administration, Trump administration, has made it very clear that it doesn't regard the subsidy and support of green energy as something that it wants to prioritize. Instead, very, very much pushing in on fossil fuels. And this means that the green energy market is now open to China. Now, they're already a long way along that path, you know, in terms of solar panels, pretty much Chinese dominated worldwide. Wind, not as much, but I think, top of my head, 75% something of turbine production happening in China at the moment. Also nuclear, which we shouldn't forget, is also a non-fossil fuel energy. The Chinese have got plenty of practice in small modular reactors and other technologies that go around the world. Now, if you are Indonesia, if you are Brazil, if you are Nigeria, if you're Kenya, if you're one of the emerging economies that's kind of on the way now, but mid-2030s, early 2040s is going to be much, much higher up the level of global GDP, emergent middle class, you have energy-hungry constituencies. And of course, more and more of them are going to be turning to green tech, not just because it's cheap, but also because in a fossil fuel scarce world, you're going to be really hungry for whatever green energy is available. And right now, the United States has made a decision that actually China is going to take that particular market. That has implications, of course, for the rest of the world. But I would say that energy fork in the road, that division, is probably one of the most powerful areas where there's going to be differentiation between those two economies for years, maybe decades to come.
Well, I know kind of leading climate change thinkers and and strategists who really think that the UK has no option but to accept the import of BYD electrically powered vehicles. If we want to hit our climate change targets, we just got to do business with the Chinese. You can't help but feel that on this one, China's on a winner. And kind of the Anglo-Saxon right, who kind of leading our countries kind of away from that agenda, kind of making a fundamental strategic mistake.
Well, just a thought on that. Well, perhaps I can put in a comment that might equally annoy at least some part of the left and some part of the right. So I'm being very even-handed here.
Well, very important to be even-handed on this podcast.
Yes, yes, even-handed, annoy everyone. But I'll tell you why I say that on this question of energy. Actually, I would say Europe, and that is a collective Europe, which certainly includes the UK, which, as you mentioned, is a tech innovator in all sorts of ways, really needs to be taking much more ownership of the green energy agenda. For in the short term, I think, yes, it's true that on solar panels, it's not possible to kind of push back against Chinese dominance now. But there's going to be the next generation, a whole variety of other areas of technology. And Europe simply, I think a lot of people feel, cannot decide that it's going to sit this one out. But it involves a lot of painful choices about, you know, shifting industries, about improving the actually quite weak pool of finance capital that exists in Europe. You know, one of the reasons all the IPOs, the initial public offerings, go to New York is that the pools of capital are so deep. And of course, China has Hong Kong, which is beginning to operate as a kind of climate finance headquarters. Europe has the capacity, broadly defined, including the City of London, that's very much part of it, to deal with these questions. But it does demand political will and political planning. Just saying, actually, let's leave everything to the Chinese, I don't think is the solution either. But it does involve that kind of, you know, real sort of thinking and planning. Again, you've been very much associated with those circles for a long time, Will. Do you think it's Europe's capable?
I want it to be, and you're quite right. I mean, that's where my thinking goes. I mean, if you want any kind of industrial technological autonomy for Europe and a capacity to be a kind of rule maker globally in standards, then it has to be either a challenger or a critical mass of industrial clout. And that has to be in, I think, areas of technology and areas of green technology. I mean, I'm absolutely sure of it. But that's what's straying a bit off.
No,
I'm happy to talk about me. We've got to talk about you. You're the man in the hot seat here, not me. I like this very much, this notion that you've developed of the United States and China being in a rivalrous relationship. They're competitively illiberal. You know, Donald Trump's United States becoming more nationalist, becoming more authoritarian, and actually beginning to kind of mimic, in some respects, some of the reflex instincts and ways of going about governance in China. And I hadn't come across that phrase before when I was kind of doing my kind of background mugging up on you, Rana. So tell me about that.
I will, and it was very kind of you to say that. Well, I've Googled it a few times. At the moment, actually, the phrase is one that, at least for the moment, I seem to have invented, which is I'm quite pleased about.
You are the inventor. You are the inventor of a phrase. You know,
and Google never lies. Let me, if I may, just adjust slightly. The phrase I actually used is competitive anti-liberalism.
Oh, anti-liberalism.
But actually, it's an important distinction in my mind, because it's trying to say the following thing. First of all, I should say the place where it appears, and listeners are very welcome to download it for free, is in a book, Lessons from the New Cold War, subtitled America Confronts the China Challenge. One of the chapters which I've written is this idea of competitive anti-liberalism as a new way of thinking about the America-China competition. So let me briefly explain what gave rise to this idea and what I mean by it. The idea was originally to talk about the American liberal project and the Chinese authoritarian project. And then it became clear to me as we moved into the new administration early on that actually the administration itself, Trump administration, would be sort of highly taken aback to be referred to as a liberal project. I mean, the one thing they would say is that we're all sorts of things, but we ain't that. And actually, I think that they would not push back, and I've talked informally to a few people in those circles, by saying, look, are you not just illiberal, but anti-liberal? And they say, yeah, you know, the liberal order is something that we think, you know, in their view, has created a neoliberal, the phrases they use, globalist, all this sort of thing, that has impoverished the American worker and brought wars to all parts of the world, Iraq and Afghanistan. We want no part of that. So yes, we are in that sense anti-liberal. We then switch over to China and think, well, if you think of one thing that the project of the Chinese Communist Party has been ever since its foundation in 1921, and ever since the foundation of the PRC, the People's Republic, in 1949, again, it's been lots of things, but it has never been liberal in the sense that most European liberals would think of that. So we actually have a new global situation where there are two big powers vying with each other for military, economic, but also cultural dominance. And they both share plenty of premises, but very different ways of looking at the world. So, you know, if you ask most American or Chinese policymakers, are you more like each other than you are unlike each other? They say, no, of course not. We're completely different. You know, those Chinese are like this and these Americans are like that. But actually, if you look at the premises that they share, for instance, the idea that actually politics is quite zero sum. You know, there are people you support. There are people you kind of, you know, throw overboard. The idea that you kind of live and let live and there's a mushy middle, this is not really the view either of the Trump administration or the CCP in that sense. The thinker who I found both sides actually find really interesting is the German legal theorist Carl Schmitt, of course, highly controversial character from the early 20th century. And yeah, he ended up actually, of course, you know, very much involved with the Third Reich. You know, this is someone who was
hardly.
But it's interesting. I mean, again, on a social science podcast, I feel able to go on about this a little bit, Will. In recent years in the Western Academy, Schmitt has been taken up by the left as much as by the right, because it's his idea, which has been adapted by thinkers like Giorgio Agamben, the state of exception, when you suddenly have to kind of pull the lever and say the rules don't apply, the norms don't apply, the laws don't apply, because we're in a state of emergency. The Aufnahmezustand, I think, is the phrase that Schmitt himself used. Now, this is something that, in a sense, fits very much into the Chinese
just
model.
Just slow down there. What was that? Just adding again in German more slowly. What was that phrase?
Sorry, Aufnahmezustand, state of exception, right, is the normal way that that's translated. So the idea that essentially you kind of have to put a spoke in the rules because we're in a situation where actually everything is not normal and we have to operate on the basis that we're in an emergency situation and, you know, normal rules don't apply. Schmitt also thought that, of course, law and the rule of law was a sort of bourgeois fiction that middle-class people made up to comfort each other. Now, you can imagine that these would be things that give the European Union, the, you know, ECHR, a whole variety of international institutions based on the idea of rule of law and human rights, an absolute heart attack. But one thing I think that the current US administration and the CCP have in common is that they both regard the construction of international law as well as domestic law as a sort of series of bourgeois comforting fictions as something they want to tear right through. So as I say, I don't think this is the way that the Chinese or the Americans would necessarily look at their own project, but analytically, and again, through a social science and humanities lens, understanding where those similarities lie, I think explains a bit more about how these two countries might interact with each other in the near future.
But that's the point. I mean, your point would be that competitive anti-liberalism means that there are areas where they're not necessarily opposed to each other. That said, I mean, that China's competitive anti-liberalism doesn't extend to wanting to dismantle the World Trade Organization. In fact, it wants to be the custodian of a new series of international rules that it benefits from.
Well, language and intentions, I think, where we look here. So first of all, the Trump administration is unique in the post-World War II experience in that it actively speaks out against global free trade. And basically, Republican and Democratic administrations of both parties have at least rhetorically been in favor of that, you know, since 1945. Although in the last two decades or so, the Biden administration, you know, had its own protectionism as well.
Yeah.
But in terms of language, they never abandoned that. The Trump people are basically, you know, again, they're going down the Schmitt line, I think, and saying, let's not pretend that we have global free trade. We don't. Robert Lighthizer, who's not in the current administration, but was the U.S. trade representative in the first Trump administration, literally wrote a book called Trade Is Not Free. And, you know, he talked about the costs, he saw it, of having that idea. Now, China does maintain its status rhetorically as saying that it wants to maintain free trade. But I think any economic analyst who's fair-minded would say that a very large part of China's economy is actually mercantilist. It's not really free trade in that wider sense. It's also heavily protected. If you don't believe me, ask a few tiny little companies with names like Google or Meta how much traction they have in China. You will find that their market share is certainly pretty restricted. There are all sorts of other non-tariff barriers in China, every bit as much as that. I mean, the US is still a more open economy than China by some way. So the language of free trade being used in China is rhetorically useful. But if you look at the actions of what's going on, we actually have two powers now dominating global trade, neither of whom wants genuinely open markets. Again, I think the EU is somewhat different, although again, of course, you know, the anti-EU folks would say that it's actually highly protectionist. But it does not sit, I think, in the driving seat of being able to drive what happens next in the way that China and the US do.
If today's conversation has sparked new ideas, you might also enjoy Transforming Society, the podcast from Bristol University Press. Transforming Society is the podcast that gets to grips with the big issues around social justice and global challenges. Each episode brings you inspiring conversations with leading authors, policymakers, and academics, people whose research shines a light on the possibilities for a fairer future. Hosted by Rich Kemp, George Miller, and Professor Martin Parker of the University of Bristol, the show goes beyond the headlines to uncover the stories research can tell and how they might just help transform society. Guests have included Kalwant Bhopal on the realities of white privilege, Karl Rhodes on the myth of the good billionaire, and John Alsop on the challenges confronting journalism today. So if you're curious about the ideas, debates, and evidence that could shape a better world, make Transforming Society your next listen. You'll find it now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major platforms. We should, I think, not allow this podcast to go on for much longer without talking about some of the weaknesses in the China's model. I mean, it's...
Of course.
It's financially chronically overstretched. It uses its banking system to support this incredible infrastructure. If it was done on Western accounting, probably a large part of the Chinese banking system is bust, actually, only held up by the state. There's chronic inequalities. It's not a happy society, is it? There's a lot of scope for things to go wrong.
I think that's right. And let me, you know, just supplement. I think your entirely accurate assessment there, Will, with a few more specifics as well. I mean, first of all, things that are going wrong with the Chinese economy right now, you know, number one is youth underemployment in the major cities. There is unemployment too, but actually
huge.
The statistics are no longer being published. But I think people who know what they're talking about suggest that in some major conurbations, you're talking about, you know, 40% of young people under 24 essentially not being able to find proper employment at all. So, you know, you can have someone with a physics degree and they're delivering noodles off the back of a food delivery truck. You know, they've got a job, but it's not a job that's suited to what they actually can do. Lots of graduate overproduction and not enough jobs to absorb them. Partly exacerbated by something that people may have not known or forgotten about, which is that China still operates a pretty tough system of residence permits, hukou as they're called, in which you're not allowed to get your full kind of welfare and other rights unless you're living in the place that you're designated. So it's not illegal to move, but if you do move, you'll leave behind many of your rights with you. And that kind of keeps people often confined. It's a way of preventing sort of slums building up in the outskirts of the cities, but it's had a kind of dampening effect on much of the economy. In addition, I think we shouldn't underestimate how much the economy has not bounced back after COVID. People are still feeling the animal spirits, to use the old Keynesian phrase, are not really leaping up in quite that sort of a way. And I'd say that one of the things that is part of the, you know, astonishing forward move of China that you mentioned in the earlier part of our conversation, Will, is also part of the problem, which is that China is really leaping ahead on many aspects of AI, you know, artificial intelligence. Overall, I think it's still fair to say the United States has the biggest lead in all sectors, but China is doing really well in a whole variety of areas where it's just putting lots of people and investment in. The problem is, it's all very well to have efficiency and quality grow in leaps and bounds with AI, but does it create any jobs? Lots of Chinese, just like lots of Americans, know which jobs are going to be destroyed by AI. It seems to be much harder to get a straight answer as to what jobs are going to be created if AI really takes off as it is doing in China, particularly in a system which has fewer pensions, less welfare, you know, all of that. So that's a very real problem that's happening right now that I have not yet heard a straight and detailed answer from, even from some of the techno-futurists who point out that China's doing really well in these areas, but don't seem to know where it's going to lead. In answer to your happiness point, which I think is, you know, such an important element, we have plenty of evidence from Chinese social media over the last few years that, you know, the kind of memes and ideas that sort of bubble up and then bubble down again. A lot of them are about people feeling alienated, feeling that the Chinese world isn't giving them what they wanted. So it's these young people talking about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the famous phrase was Tang Ping lying flat. In other words, just sort of opting out of the rat race. That isn't being used so much now, but there are other phrases that have, you know, some sense of that in the present day. That has to do with a sort of sense of malaise, perhaps, in terms of employment, more generally speaking. But the flip side I have to mention, because again, we have to be full spectrum on this, is that for an awful lot of people, who see the world outside changing very fast, they are perhaps more willing to take some authoritarian part of the bargain if they can get some kind of economic certainty. And that was true for many people in the countryside, particularly for a long time, who were not always very kind of actively politicized. The problem right now is that China is pushing down hard on the authoritarian side and the surveillance side, but is not producing the kind of go-go economic growth that's supposed to be other side of the bargain. And that's a real problem.
Now, look, we're getting to the end of this, and I'm going to have to start pushing you a bit. I'm going to try and sum up what I understand you to have said, and you're going to say, no, or yes. Far from the United States and China in a rivalry that could lead to world war, you are saying, no, these are two competitively anti-liberal economies. Paradoxically, they see the world in not dissimilar terms and less fundamentally to argue about because they've both got well-defined spheres of influence that they respect. That actually China, certainly for all its phenomenal strengths, has this problem. Ultimately, the Chinese Communist Party is not legitimate and that authoritarianism is fine up if you deliver living standards, but if you stop doing that and jobs, you're in trouble. Getting out of trouble by invading Taiwan is not an obvious solution. Technologically, kind of in many areas, a challenge of the United States, if not preeminent. But don't allow yourselves, listeners, to get cataclysmic about this. These two powers are going to manage their affairs, and indeed have done, in response to tariff wars launched by Trump. They seem to be finding a way through it. That's how I've heard you. Am I right?
I think that's generally a very fair summary, actually, Will. I think what I do, rather than repeating your words back to you, is just to say that I think we are right now, we're speaking, as I say, in early October of 2025, in a very fast-changing moment. And I think one of the changes that even a year from now, maybe we should come back and have a chat, a year from now, I think we will know the answer to, is whether or not we are in a fundamental change in the way the United States regards the China challenge. Because up to now, I think it's fair to say that for, let's say, the last 20 years or so, the US has regarded China as a competitive challenge. And that includes making sure that the competition in technology and so forth is one where America must be ahead of time.
And they still do. I mean, they're anxious to regain semiconductor manufacture, et cetera, aren't they?
They are, although it seems sometimes that their beef is against Taiwan, which is on the Allied side rather than the Chinese side. But I think a lot more of that competition is going to turn economic and technological. And there are signals coming out that maybe the military alliances with allies in the region are going to be certainly not abandoned, but certainly perhaps less prioritized in terms of the way in which the China challenge is focused. And perhaps more emphasis, as has already happened in Europe, on pushing Japan, Korea, and other allies in the region to do more on their own. Now, whether that would actually be a productive outcome is hard to say because many of the allies in the region are very, very keen to keep American presence in the region. I never thought they'd have to calculate what would happen if America didn't actually want to be there as much. But I think that question of how high the current US administration and its successors regard the China challenge as being on the wide sort of to-do list of American policy is going to be one of the great issues of our time. And I can tell you that everyone in Beijing is keeping close notes on what's happening in the Western world in general, and in the US in particular, and adjusting their behavior accordingly.
Last word. I mean, should the British government engage with China, keep its distance from China? What's your advice to us?
I would say that a formula that's come up from the British government has been that Britain needs to compete on economic terms where it's helpful to do that, cooperate on areas like climate change where it's necessary to do so, and be prepared to confront in areas, for instance, such as human rights on the Hong Kong issue a few years ago, where it's necessary to do that too. The three C's are not a bad way for, you know, a medium-sized liberal power, which still has tremendous economic interests, both with the United States and with China, to navigate. But it's important to remember that all three of those are important, and that it's important not to forget that keeping values at the highest level possible on issues like Hong Kong is as important as making sure that economic prosperity is also kept in mind at a time when sources for growth, which, you know, the UK is currently
badly in need of,
are being pursued with such vigour.
Ryan, that was a good payoff. Thank you so much for giving up your time. Really illuminating. Really illuminating. And I think that...
Always a pleasure, Will. Thank you.
And this left us with one overriding thought. Well, two thoughts. Don't get too carried away by this rather gloomy consensus, and do everything in your power to understand more about this extraordinary country that is China. Thank you very much, Rana. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.